Lacey. Lacey, do you want to just introduce yourself?
Can you do me next?
Yes.
Thank you.
Matthew, do you want to say a few words about your interest in the advisory committee and your background a bit?
Sure, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And I just want to say how appreciative I am to be involved and be here to Mayor Carbone for submitting my name. And about a little bit about myself, I am been here in the Monterey Bay Area for about 5 years. Grew up in Southern California, and really that's probably the root of my interest in air quality, as you could probably imagine just from that, saying that alone. But growing up outside Los Angeles, very smoggy area, really affected the health of a lot of people I know. So air quality has always been something that I'm very aware of, and really a part of my larger work and studying in urban planning. And an important part of our environment. So with all that together, that is the basis of my interest. And I work at Cal State Monterey Bay. I'm a senior facilities planner there. And so in my role as a facilities planner and shaping the university, the physical environment is critical and the health of our students and the community. So that all leads to my interest to being here, and I really appreciate the opportunity and I'm excited to get started.
Great. Next, Karen Gray.
Hi, Karen Gray. A little bit about myself. I've been coming to the Monterey Bay Area since I was a teenager from San Francisco. And I just bought a house in Carmel about a year ago today. And when I moved here, I was really surprised at how much there was wood smoke pollution in my community. So I started a campaign called Clear the Air Carmel. You might have heard about it. We have a website and on Twitter and Instagram, trying to inform the community about the dangers of wood smoke to your health and your community. And that's pretty much why I was interested in being part of the Air Quality Council here in Monterey Bay and San Benito and Santa Cruz as well. So I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Welcome. And Caitlin?
Yes, hi, hello. My name is Caitlin. I'm actually about to graduate from UC Irvine with a political science degree. So my main field of interest is comparative in US politics, and I'm hoping to get a master's in public policy. I haven't exactly picked the school yet. So that's part of why I wanted to join the Air Quality Board, looking for opportunities and experiences, especially within my local air community. And my main interest with the environment actually stemmed from my high school, like marine biology project. That's what it was. So learning about actually how important taking care of the ocean is, because that's about, it depends on who you ask, but it's anywhere from 50 to 80% of where our oxygen comes from. So learning about how everything's connected became important to me and how to take care of our planet. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You'll have to excuse the dogs. Keep letting them out and they want in. Now's the time for comments from the public on items not on the agenda. Are there any comments?
Forgot Lacey.
Did you want to come back to Mrs. Rock?
Yeah.
Lacey?
I can try again now. There's no fire alarms going off in the background, so you'll hopefully be able to hear me. Although there is still a little bit of noise, so I apologize for that. Thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to introduce myself and to join this advisory committee. During the introductions, as mentioned, my name is Lacey Rock. I currently work as the sustainability director at CSU Monterey Bay. But my educational background in history is in international environmental policy. And with that background, I, of course, traveled and studied abroad a lot and saw firsthand just the devastation that comes from poor air quality, poor air monitoring, air pollution, and all kinds of other community impacts when we're not caring for our environment in a holistic manner. So I'm always proud to be engaged in community activities, and this is an important one to be a part of. I also serve as chair of the Seaside Environmental Commission, and I'm very happy to be working with all of you to help our community.
Thank you very much. So do we have any members of the public who want to speak? If not, now's the time to comment on the meeting summary of March 4th. Are there any corrections, additions to the minutes summary? If not, we will accept them as submitted. Our next item is to receive a presentation on the electric bicycle incentive program. Dave Frisbee.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Dave Frisbee. I'm the Planning and Air Monitoring Manager here at the district. Wanted to just introduce this next topic. In March, the Board of Directors adopted the AB 2766 program for this coming fiscal year. The program takes $4 from every registered vehicle in the district, and we use that for funding transportation projects. Air District doesn't usually regulate transportation projects, so this is our opportunity to reduce emissions from transportation. And so we've funded many projects, things such as roundabout design, adaptive signal control technology, medium duty fleet electrification. That's something that we started last year, and the electric vehicle incentive program. This year, our board asked us to look into adding the electric bicycles, so providing an incentive to purchase electric bicycles. So I'm going to turn it over to Alan Romero, our senior planner here, and he can take you through the proposed program.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome new members of the advisory committee. As my manager mentioned before, we had presented our fiscal year program to the board as well as the advisory committee. And we also engaged in some guidance from the advisory committee about implementing an electric bike incentive program. And that guidance was well taken. We took that to the board, and the board added a little more to it in last month's meeting and asked staff to go back and come back with a little more research as to where electric bikes are in the transportation space. So with that, I'm going to share my screen. Hopefully I do this correctly. I always have fun with this. Let's see, it should be that one, and we'll go into the slideshow. So can everybody see that?
No.
No, I'm not doing good. Let's try this one. Nope. Okay, what did I not do? Let's see. Oh, I have to hit the share button.
There you go.
Okay, let me start that again. All right, I think we're there. All good?
Yep.
Cool. Electric bikes have been around a while, and there's been a preponderance of a rather swift growth in the world. I think worldwide in 2015, there were about 36 million units that were sold. And that projection out to the year 2035 is to be 100 million. Primarily, and this is not surprising, the majority of the sales are in Asia, in particular China. As a matter of fact, in current use right now as we speak, there are over 200 million e-bikes in operation in China right now. In the US, the e-bike sales growth has been small, but is increasing. And we're looking at somewhere in the vicinity of 250,000 units that have been sold since 2016. One thing I wanted to present to the board is a little bit of background about classification to the advisory committee. There are typically three classes of e-bikes that were defined and designated by the Bicycle Product Suppliers Association. This classification has been codified in the state of California, as well as 21 other states. And the definitions are class one, class two, class three. And primarily the biggest differential is class three, which is a pedal assisted bike, which has the ability to reach 28 miles an hour, pedaling pretty fast, but you've got an operated assist with an electric motor. The law states, and this is federal law as well, states that all e-bikes manufactured and sold in the US have to be 750 watts or less, which is one horsepower. And that's what keeps them from being designated as motorized vehicles. Also, another stipulation of state law here in California is that class one and class two bikes are the only ones allowed on multi-use trails. Class three may be used on multi-use trails, but only with local authorization. So some of the California legislation that's kind of spurred some of this growth started in 2015, defining what an electric bicycle is. And then in 2019, SB 400 added the first, it was the first incentive program centering around e-bikes. And it was attached to the existing Clean Cars for All program, which is an ARB run program. And it's basically a replacement car. You know, you swap in your junker and you get an electric car. In this case, they added an e-bike as well to that. So you have to replace a vehicle to get to be incentivized to purchase an e-bike. That was codified in 2020. Some of the things that there are two pieces of legislation that are pending, one at the state level, which is AB 117. And it wants to add the e-bike incentives to the state air quality improvement plan, which is a little more encompassing, a little bit more less prescriptive, and open to more than just disadvantaged communities. And then on the federal level, both Leon Panetta and Congressman Blumenauer are proposing the E-Bike Act, which provides a federal tax credit of $1,500 for e-bikes purchases. And it puts a cap of spending for the cost of the bike at $8,000. Those are pretty expensive bicycles. One of the things I think that helps understand class one, class two, class three is putting it in contrast with a regular conventional pedal only bicycle. So the type one e-bike goes 20 miles an hour, it's pedal assisted. The most popular is the type two bike, which actually has a built-in throttle. So if you don't want to pedal, you can go ahead and throttle up to 20 miles an hour. And then after that, the electric motor is governed and you have to assist with the pedal. And of course, the type three bike is capable of reaching 28 miles an hour. That's also pedal assisted. And then you can see the moped down below, which is considered a motorized vehicle by the DMV. Obviously the bicycles are not. We did some research and found probably one of the most comprehensive surveys that's been done to date in the United States. And this was done by three gentlemen from the Portland State University. And under a grant from the National Institute for Transportation and Communities, they submitted a really encompassing survey of current electric bicycle owners in the North American region, which included Canada. This was done in 2018. This was a follow-up to their baseline study, which was done in 2013. We just picked some of the more interesting metrics. This was a very lengthy, in-depth survey that was sent to 1,796 existing e-bike owners, the majority of them in the United States, the rest of them in Canada. But what was really kind of telling about this with current e-bike owners, for commuting to and from work, the preponderance was to use their e-bike. 34% said, that's how I get to work. Whereas 28% said, I use my carpool, passenger, or And let me see, and then driving alone was only, excuse me, that was 28%. Driving alone was carpooling was 3%. Personal errands, you can see that driving alone was probably the preferred way to get to and from. And you can see the other categories of visiting, entertainment, and exercise and recreation. If you look at recreation, you can see the top winner was obviously the use of the e-bike. One of the things that also came out of the metrics was the type of e-bikes that existing e-bike owners are using. The standard e-bike, which would be your class one, class two, 39% of the owners own standard e-bikes, 27% own the mountain bike, which would be your class three type bike. And you can see the other configurations. The step through is a lower profile bike, folding obviously very, very small. The cargo bike is used for transporting either passengers or cargo. If you go to the grocery store and you shop a lot, you probably want to have a cargo e-bike. Again, the sample size was 1796. So there's I think, reliable statistical significance in the fact that they surveyed so many people. Another good, interesting metric was ranking from one, first, second, and third. What do you use your car? What do you use your e-bike for? You can see that the winner there was to replace car trips. And that's a pretty telling metric. I think the question was posed by the advisory committee last go around about, would these e-bike incentives actually help people replace their car trips with the e-bike? And I think this metric pretty much validates that. I think they would. So the top three were replace car trips to ride with less effort and also for use of recreational purposes. So to make it really quick and simple, because we've put this before both advisory committee and board already, the board suggested that we allocate about $50,000 from our AB 2766 budget to offer up a pilot e-bike incentive program. Nominal numbers would be $150 per applicant, and to double that amount to $300 if the applicant is low income qualified. One of the things that we're proposing to the board is limiting the purchase for a new e-bike locally. So from local dealers only, no online sales, no out of counties sale. And I think that speaks economic equity as well as environmental equity. And lastly, we're looking at capping the total cost of the e-bike not to exceed $2,500. We don't want to incentivize people to go out and buy the top of the line Cadillac mountain bike type three bikes, which can well exceed $8,000 per bike. So we kind of want to keep as a pilot program, just keep it limited, and then we can learn more as the program proceeds. And with that, are there any questions?
So Alan, let me jump in too and just say that, you know, in addition to questions you may have, we're looking to you to provide any kind of constructive comments to help us shape the program as we move forward. We're sort of building the airplane as we fly. So we don't really have any other program to copy or anything like that, except for our incentive program for electric cars. So one thought, just listening to Alan's presentation, I had is that maybe we do not want to incentivize the purchase of mountain bikes, because they're not really used for commuting, they're used for recreation. And so we're not really concerned if somebody wants to use an e-bike on a trail, but it doesn't really reduce car trip because they're not gonna probably get an e-bike instead of a Jeep. So so those are the types of things we're looking at. And if you have any ideas, we're calling this a pilot program. So we're not sure, depending on how successful it is to implement. Another issue we have, as we know, and this may have been mentioned last time, is that, you know, Costco is selling e-bikes for as little as $350. And they look to be pretty hazardous. I mean, they have really tiny wheels and they're more of a scooter slash, calling it a bicycle is being very generous. So we might want to put some constraints around those types on the lower end, what we want to fund, because we want it to be reliable and also something that folks would turn to use. So with that, you guys have input, you know, and no idea is too small. And we'll tabulate your ideas and try to put in a coherent strategy and when we bring this to the board for adoption and approval.
I believe one of the items based on the last presentation was how do you quantify emission reductions from vehicles? So it looks as though, Alan, you found some good data to quantify emission reductions. Are there comments, recommendations from the committee on this program?
We have four hands raised. We have Lacey Rock and Matthew McClooney and Jeff Davis and Alan Stroh.
So Lacey, do you want to chime in here?
Sure. Thanks. Thank you very much for the presentation. And I appreciate that you're considering e-bikes. I think we've all seen a rise in them, even if it's not quite as much as some other countries. We're definitely seeing a lot more of them on the road, and they do provide a benefit. Full disclosure, my husband and I both ride e-bikes to work, and we got rid of a car after doing that. So one question I have, though, is before I delve into any more comments, is just what percentage of the budget, I think you gave us the amount, but I'm wondering what percentage of the overall budget that was.
10%. Roughly 10%.
Do you have any other comments?
I have other comments, but I'll let the other colleagues go in case they have clarifying questions before me.
Next person, Matthew.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And thank you, Alan, for the great presentation. I also really appreciated the data you provided. Besides the environmental benefits, obviously we have data that e-bikes provide very direct economic benefit if commuting is largely how they're used. So I think that was great data. I was hoping you could speak a little bit more towards the point about limiting purchases to the Tri-County area. And I very much appreciate you bringing up equity. But I'm not as familiar with at what point e-bikes are in how ubiquitous they are in sales across the area, you know, being maybe a more affordable version at Costco, but maybe not a one that would be recommended. Of course, for equity's sake, we want folks to be able to buy affordable versions. We want them also local, but is the market at a place where local is also affordable? So could you speak to that a little bit?
I'd love to be able to tell you all of those, the answers to all of those questions. But as Rich pointed out, this is as a pilot program, we are definitely not expert on e-bike anything. So I think that the local dealers would know best. And one of the things that the three gentlemen from Portland State did was they really went out and talked to everybody, and that included dealers. And I think that I remember when we first opened up our light duty electric vehicle incentive program, Matthew, one of the board members who's still on the board was gravely concerned about tax revenue and the loss of tax revenue if we allowed light duty vehicle, electric vehicle buyers to go outside the three counties. Fortunately for us, with a vehicle, a car, electric car, the DMV is taxed on where you reside. So we didn't really lose any you know revenue stream there. Unfortunately, with the sale of an e-bike, if you buy one online, nobody sees the tax benefit there. And so that's the reason why we're just kind of putting that out there. I think obviously we work at the discretion of the board, and that's what staff is proposing. And we'll just see how that plays out. I think that if this is a successful program, that gives us the ability to widen it to be less prescriptive. And I think then we can get a better feel for what's equitable, what isn't. I think that Rich made a very, very good point on both ends of the spectrum. Incentivizing the purchase of something that isn't safe enough to be used on the road or even the bike paths is one thing. Also, and the other end of it, I mean, some of these mountain bikes can exceed $8,000 in cost. And we're not really at this point in time so eager to go jump on that bandwagon. but love the fact that people are doing it, but we want to kind of find that sweet spot, and we're just starting out. So I hope that answers your questions.
It does. Thank you. And I guess I just finished with a comment that I think buying local is absolutely desirable. But if we want to keep it as wide open as possible, that would be my comment for the moment. So thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Alan, do you have comments?
So far my comment was already answered, but I did have a little self-serving question, and that is this program with members of the agency and us as committee members be eligible for the program, or are we not eligible?
You're eligible.
We are eligible?
Yes.
Oh, that's good. Because I was actually thinking about getting one. So thank you.
Okay, Karen or Jeff Davis? Jeff, do you have a comment? You're muted.
Yes, I have a question, two actually. One, first of all, to be clear, scooters do qualify for this, correct?
That wasn't the intent in going.
I see it listed in the data though, so I wanted to make sure if it was listed in the data that it is part of the project.
What we really like to do at the suggestion of the board was to really look at electric bicycles. And I think that as a pilot program, we don't want to broaden that scope too much. When you think about electric skateboards that are out there on the Monterey County Rec, I don't know if you've been on the Monterey Rec Trail yet, but you see them all. You see the skateboards, you see the e-bikes, you see the e-scooters. There's this one crazy device that's got one big fat wheel. It looks like a skateboard. There's a lot of traffic out there, and I certainly don't think the district is looking to add to a congestion or safety problem. So anyway.
So no e-scooters or scooters are not eligible for the benefit, or is this something you're saying that they are, because if they're not, I mean, we're looking at data that included them.
Right.
Not huge numbers, but.
Right. And that's why the data was, if you looked at that entire report, and there are a lot more metrics that obviously we didn't have. I didn't want to burden everybody with tons of metrics, but if you look at the metrics, you can clearly see where the emphasis is. It's in the class two bike.
Okay. To clarify, so scooters are not eligible for this.
Correct.
Okay.
It's going to just be electric bicycles.
Okay. Thank you. And then second question was, do you have any data on how many people have said, you know what, because of these incentive programs, I'm ditching my car, I'm going e-bike, versus people that are like, well, I've already got an e-bike, or I'm getting an e-bike, as Alan had said, I'm already going to do it. This is just bonus on top.
The reason why I put that, the title cover to that report, because it's a very exhaustive, it's really extensive. I know that you can find a metric that'll answer that question. I just don't have it in front of me. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. I appreciate the presentation. Thank you for coming up. That's all the questions I have.
If I may just jump in and answer, I think this answers Janet's question too, or comment earlier. We hope to incorporate some sort of survey to capture some of that information from the people. Now it's going to be their word, right? So we expect them to tell us if they're going to be displacing a car as a result of, or at least vehicle travel, miles traveled. So we hope to generate some data through this project, but realize that there's probably an inherent bias in that.
I'd like to.
Alan, yes, Karen.
I'm sorry.
Karen Gray had a comment.
Yeah, so I'm an e-bike rider, and I did a lot of research when I bought my e-bike. I can't imagine one of much quality other than under probably $1,500. So to me, I think the cost for an e-bike is prohibitively expensive for most workers, especially wage workers who might be commuting among the communities. Why not offer this incentive for bicycles as well? Because there are people who can't afford bicycles, and we could get them just regular bicycles. Thanks.
Alan, do you want to respond to that?
Did you call me?
She was saying since electric bicycles are so expensive, why not have a program for regular bicycles? And I think we probably do, but.
Well, I'll step in and answer that. We do not have a program for regular bicycles. That's a really good point. That's one that I struggled with too. You know, actually there's a benefit to riding a bike that far outweighs an electric bike because you're getting the health benefit as well. So at this point, we're not looking at, we think it's easier for most people to use a an electric bike, a motorized vehicle. We don't have a lot of, we used to invest heavily in bike trail development, as Janet well knows. We bike paths to nowhere, and there's no master communication or strategy to put those together. So it's a little more difficult to commute on a bicycle. You can do share with motorized vehicles, but that's something we could look to in the future. And certainly I would bring that comment to the board of directors because I think it is valid. And I personally, I'm not an electric bike fan. I'm a bicyclist. I like human power. I think that's where your exercise and the health benefits, and it's no tax on the environment at all. So, but good comment.
Alan, you're next.
Yes, you know, there was a comment about getting a bike, just maybe not having any effect on the environment. But I think one could keep in mind that the bike I was considering was a cargo bicycle that for my wife, because she's not a real big bicyclist. I like getting on the bike, my bike, and riding just for recreation. But I would think that we could displace some trips on our cars if we didn't get rid of them, but displace trips like to the market, which is fairly close to us that we normally go to. And if you had a cargo bike, you could load it up with some groceries and zoom on home and not have all the parking issues. And so that was my intent. And it's not just about getting rid of a car, but maybe displacing trips in cars too. Just a point I wanted to make.
Hi, David, Matt, you had comments?
Yeah, I had the same question, I guess, that Karen had, is did we have a program for the for regular bicycles? And I guess we've answered that. But I guess, not to be the naysayer, I'm struggling with $150 incentive is not, in my opinion, enough to incentivize somebody to go spend $1,500 on a quality e-bike, right? I guess my struggle is if we're trying to displace emissions and other environmental effects, why aren't we focusing that money on incentives for e-vehicles? I know we already have the program, but to encourage more people to do that and maybe supply greater incentives for the e-vehicles, or if that's not the idea, make it a little more affordable for somebody to buy a quality, durable, long-lasting e-bike besides $150.
Just one comment, you know, part of the evaluation of these programs is to look at cost effectiveness, which is looks at in terms of emission reductions per dollar spent. So, you know, that is always a consideration. Lacey, you had an additional comment?
Sure, thank you. I wanna share a story actually that a student shared with me. She's a CSUMB student, she's third year, she's low income, minority representing. She works at Bubba Gump's down on Cannery Row, and she lives on East Campus. And she was sharing the struggle that she has to get on two different buses and often travel 2 hours on public transportation to get from home to work. And that is often longer at the end of a shift when it's close to midnight. And so we were talking, and a faculty member who rides an e-bike to work said, "I love my e-bike. I ride it into downtown Monterey. You should totally get one because it's a great option. And her only other option that she was considering was to buy a car. I share that story to give you sort of a personal impact that an incentive like this has. And also to echo David's comment that, I think $150 just is kind of a too small of a drop in the bucket. I think if we have $50,000 to spend, if we really want to incentivize people to do something, we give them $1,000 and sell 50 bikes, because $150 isn't gonna support a student like the one I was talking to. It's just not enough. They can't come up with the rest of it. And for people like me, who I'm already inclined to ride and purchase an e-bike, and I'll spend $2,000 on it because it reflects my values and it provides an option that I care about. $150, I wouldn't probably go through the bureaucratic process of filling out the paperwork. I'd just spend the $150. So I'll leave that comment there.
Matthew, additional comments?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I wanted to add to now the three other members and their comments about cost and the incentives, and simply maybe pose the suggestion of and I understand this is an early program and there's a lot that's unknown, particularly the maybe changing costs of e-bikes, but could the incentive be matched by percentage to the average cost of an e-bike, like to a similar degree that the incentive is for electric vehicles? And so that's a question maybe for Alan, is could there be a similar ratio of money put towards the incentive based on the average vehicle, the incentive, and an average e-bike and the incentive? Is there something there that can be started as a standard, knowing that the costs will change over time?
So Spencer, you're next.
Yes, thank you. I know that there's not a lot of money for marketing in a project like this, but I wonder if just as part of the internal communications outreach thinking, the targeting of the messaging might be part of the value of the program. So if you think about if it's a broad-based outreach, and you're reaching people who are relatively well off to whom $150 doesn't really make very much difference, and then other people, you know, where the right amount of money would be very persuasive for them and would make the difference between 2 hours on public transportation or having to resort to a car, that might help to make the whole thing more productive. So I just wanted to mention that, and I guess turn that into a question and ask if that is part of the current thinking or perhaps down the road.
Thank you. David, Mac?
Yeah, I guess one question while everybody else was talking that I have is, can people be repeat users of this program? So if they get $150 and they spend $600 and their e-bike breaks, because I'm thinking of college students or, you know, just entering into the job market. So say they buy a lower quality e-bike and they get $150 and it breaks in a year. Do they get to reapply next year when they have to buy a new bike? Or are they going to be prohibited from using the program more than once?
Alan?
Yes. Oh, the other Alan.
I was waiting for an answer to his question, but.
The answer would be probably yes, because we do the same thing for the electric vehicles. It's we allow one incentive per family per year. And the state, we try to follow what the state does. The state says two max. So you could do this 2 years in a row. You try to go for your third one, you probably wouldn't be eligible. If we do what we've done with the vehicles, we've pretty much mirrored what the state does, and we would probably do something similar with the bikes.
And really quick, can I just follow up? The reason I asked that question is I don't own an e-bike, but I have some friends that bought a lower quality e-bike, and when the electronic component went out, it is more than $150 to fix that bike. So at some level, if you're not investing in a medium to higher quality e-bike, you're buying a very disposable product, unlike a traditional bike that gets fixed.
Spencer, do you have a comment?
Yes, thanks. I realize I could probably clarify what I was just saying. So in referring quickly to the marketing concept, I think that would also help to set the price point, because, you know, a traditional way about thinking of marketing a product is in terms of the four P's of product, placement, price, and promotion. And all of those things act together when you are targeting a particular market segment. So I think it would help not just in terms of messaging, but in terms of deciding whether $150 is the appropriate amount of money or whether it should be larger. And that could be set by understanding who the target market is, so that, and you end up having more bang for the buck usually by selling something to a segment rather than trying to sell it to everybody. So that I think would be a way to maximize the productivity in terms of vehicle trips saved for this program.
Alan?
Yeah, I did price out e-bikes a while back, and you know, if you're going to get a decent one, they're up around 2,000 plus, and you know, just a standard bicycle can run you $1,500, and that's not really an expensive one. So I don't know that $150. I agree. I think that where the conversation is going here is that you really need to look at the social equity thing and see where your bang for your buck is in terms of people that would actually use the bike in lieu of buying that car, like the student, or you know, doing those trips where you're taking a car off the road, like where our lower income folks can't afford a car, and the e-bike sounds like a really good solution to that for some of these commutes. And I think you ought to really take a look at fixing the cost of this program to really look at the cost of these e-bikes, you know, the practical cost of them, and fix it to that percentage as was suggested earlier.
Okay, Richard.
Yeah, I just wanted to say these are really good comments, and I appreciate the questions and feedback that we've gotten. We sort of set it up, and we pulled that out of the air a little bit. We also used sort of the ratio of what we're doing for the electric vehicles. Remember, for a $30,000 to $60,000 vehicle, we're only giving a maximum of $2,000 to incentivize that. Sure, we could use, we could, you know, give everybody $30,000 and make sure they're going to use those vehicles, but that there's a sweet spot in trying to maximize how many people are going to use or get the benefit. So we don't have any magic number. What I'm hearing, I heard $1,000, you know, so we can take a look at that. And, you know, there are no other programs, as I said, I'm aware of that's doing this currently. And we thought that that would be something that would be really good. The other thing I just want to say in regards to e-bikes and bicycles, there's a significant shortage out there right now. So this program's going to have a real hard time getting off the ground, you know, right after COVID. So I think we'll bring this to the board. We'll take a look and see if we can get any better data on how much the incentive should be. But, you know, we're not, certainly we don't want to have an unsuccessful program by offering too little. But then again, I don't want to give away public dollars either. So that's sort of the dilemma we're having. So, but I think we can do a little more research on this.
I'm going to second Spencer's comment, targeting the audience. It seems students on CSUMB or some of these university campuses that are so huge and so amenable to getting around on bicycles. It seems that students at CSUMB might be more attuned. So let's, we have three more comments and then let's move on to the next agenda item. Lacey.
Thanks. Yeah, the last speaker just reminded me of one of my other comments, and that's that just to consider, because bikes are in such shortage right now, at least for this year or, you know, the next 2 years, to allow people to buy the bikes from wherever they can get it. I do want to support local economy 100%, but I think there's a real limitation this year that we would want to acknowledge and account for it, you know, and we can always change that again once the supply chain sort of levels out a little bit, but I'd recommend opening it up a little bit more.
Thank you, David Mack.
I was just gonna ask, what happens if the program gets put into place and it's not utilized fully? What happens to that, the remainder of that money?
Alan, you're muted.
I'll just say that that money would probably go back into our general fund, and then we'd make a decision. We've done this with the electric vehicle program too. First year, we didn't spend all the funds down. It went back in to our general fund, and then we designed the program later with a higher incentive. So we've been playing around with the incentive amount, trying to find that sweet spot. So so it wouldn't just evaporate. It's money we have, and we could allocate, run the program differently if we wanted to offer it again the next year. And so, yeah, we don't lose the money or anything like that.
The last comment, Karen.
All right, I'm going to throw a little bit of a wrench in here, but one thing, I mean, have you considered a bicycle share program like there is in San Francisco, where people just share the bicycles? It's quite affordable for everybody, and it's utilized a lot. I mean,
it's a long story, but yes, we have.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for all the great input to this program. The next item is a presentation by Amy Climo on Engineering Compliance Division, and this is for information.
Yes, good afternoon. So since we have several new members, we thought it might be helpful to kind of go through what some of our different teams do. And so I'm gonna talk today about what we do in the engineering compliance side of the house. It's not quite as fun as giving away incentives for e-bikes, but it does help with air quality. So this is our mission, and our mission is to protect public health and the environment while balancing economic and air quality considerations. And so our engineering and compliance divisions do this through ensuring compliance with federal, state, and local air quality regulations. And as we've talked before, we do cover Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz counties. So on the engineering side of the house, we accept permit applications, and we check those for compliance with regulations. We issue permits with operating conditions. We develop rules and regulations, and we report annual emission inventory data. So today I'm just gonna go over the first two bullets. So I'm not gonna go into any more detail about rule development and emission inventory. It's gonna be too much for one day. So why would anyone need a permit? Well, you need a permit so that we can make sure that the equipment or process that you want to operate will meet the federal, state, and local air quality regulations. And when we are looking at equipment and processes to permit, we're looking at mainly two categories of pollutants. We're looking at criteria pollutants. Those are ozone, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and particulate matter. And those are what we measure with our ambient air quality monitors that are located around all three counties. Then the other thing that we are also evaluating is the toxic air contaminants that might be coming from that process. And that would be diesel particulate matter, benzene, formaldehyde, or toluene. And the most simple example I can give you of why we need to check these is that there's a state regulation for diesel engines rated at greater than 50 horsepower. And it's a tiered system. And you're only allowed to operate a certain tiered diesel engine. And so we need to make sure that the engine that you want to install and use meets that state regulation. So this slide just has an example of the most common types of permit applications that we routinely receive. So often we're receiving diesel engine permits greater than 50 horsepower. And in most cases, those are emergency engines, especially because we've had the public safety power shutoff events from PG&E. We're seeing a lot more businesses wanting to install backup power in case the electricity is cut. We see a lot of boilers, and boilers rated at greater than 2 million BTU per hour is the size boiler that we permit. We see concrete batch plants, gas stations, paint booths, coffee roasters, and we do permit cannabis extraction. And these are some of the more routine sources that we do permit, but we do also, you've probably seen some of our larger sources like the Moss Landing Power Plant or the oil and gas facilities. And those fall into a category. Those have been permitted for decades with the Air District, and those fall into a separate category called Title V. And these are our major sources, and they're subject to a federal permitting program in addition just to the local district program. And then I also just wanted to touch on agricultural operations. And so this would be equipment used for the growing of crops or raising of fowl or animals. And so in most cases, that equipment is exempt from district permitting requirements. We do have a diesel engine registration program. So those diesel engines that might power an irrigation pump, we would register those engines in our program. So this is just a high level overview of our permit application process. And so when we receive an application, it's assigned to one of our three engineers, and they have 30 days to review that application and determine whether or not it's complete. If the application is complete, it moves on to the next step. If it's deemed incomplete, we let the applicant know that we need some information and that time clock stops. So the next step is the engineering evaluation, and the engineer has 180 days to complete their evaluation. And then once that evaluation is done and they've made sure that the equipment can meet all of our requirements, they'll issue something called an authority to construct. And so the idea here is we have sort of a two-step process, is we need to review the equipment that you want to operate. And then we say, yes, you can install the equipment. We're going to give you this authority to construct. And then they install that equipment. And then we need to do a startup inspection to make sure that all of the information they gave us in the application that we evaluate actually matches what they've installed. And if it does, then we will issue them a permit. So I'll go into a little more detail on some of these steps. So the engineering evaluation is where we really go into the details of looking at all of the applicable federal, state, and local regulations, make sure that that equipment or process can meet those regulations. In particular, we have Rule 207, that's our new source review rule. That's really the heart of the engineering evaluation. And we're looking at the criteria pollutant emissions when we're doing that rule evaluation. And depending on the amount of emissions from equipment or process, they may be subject to something called best available control technology or offsets. And then finally, the engineer will go through our rules 1000 and 1010, and those are our two toxics rules. So that's where they'll look at those toxics air contaminants that I mentioned earlier. So this is an example of what an authority to construct looks like. And once the engineer has finished their evaluation and deemed that the equipment or process can meet our requirements, they'll issue this, and it's a listing of the conditions that will be required of this equipment once it is installed and operating. And it looks, this is the permit to operate. It looks very similar to the permit to operate. And you can see here, the emission unit is described at the top of the permit. So it tells you that this is a diesel engine, how many horsepower it is, the tier of the engine. A permit really needs to have some type of limits so that the person can, we can ensure, that's one way we ensure that they're meeting our rules and regulations. And so in this case, this emergency engine is only allowed to operate 30 hours per year for maintenance and testing. And so in order to make sure that they are following that, then they need to keep a record of how many hours the engine's operated for maintenance and testing. And that has to be separated from the number of hours it's operated in an emergency situation. And those types of conditions are how we make sure that compliance is achieved when they're using their equipment. So this is just an example of the number of permits we have in these different types. So we have 1,147 emergency engine permits. We have 229 retail gas stations, 303 paint spray facilities, 206 boilers, and 150 prime engines. So once a permit's issued from engineering, it's handed off to our compliance team. And our compliance team consists of six inspectors, and they go out and they check on all of these permitted sources to make sure that they're meeting their permit conditions. We also have a team that enforces the federal asbestos regulation, and then our compliance team also responds to complaints from the public. So when an inspector goes out and does an inspection, we're checking for compliance with those permit conditions for that engine, for example, making sure they're keeping their log so that we know they didn't go out over their 30 hours per year for their maintenance and testing. And we also review source tests. So some of our permitted equipment, like a boiler, larger boilers, sometimes will be required to do what's called a source test. And in that case, a third party comes out and takes measurements of the pollutants in the stack of that boiler. And they compare those with what the permit requires them to meet. And so those are done annually and just to make sure that they're meeting those permit emission limits. So sometimes people aren't doing what their permit is telling them to do. And so we have some enforcement tools. And the first one is called a notice to comply. And the next elevation of that is a notice of violation. And then we have a mutual settlement program where we try to achieve compliance and settle these violations through penalties. So a notice to comply is typically for first-time violations or administrative violations, such as not maintaining that log, showing us that you're meeting your 30-hour, you're not going over that 30-hour per year limit for your engine. And typically in this case, the inspector will give the permit holder a time frame. In 7 days, you need to demonstrate to me that you're achieving compliance to correct this violation. And so in the case of an engine, it would just be demonstrating that they've started to maintain that log. So for violations that don't qualify for an NTC, such as if that emergency engine did operate for more than 30 hours for maintenance and testing, or if they failed their source test, then they're given a notice of violation. And when you're given a notice of violation, that's usually going to lead to penalties. And so we give the permit holder a questionnaire so that they're able to explain to us why the violation happened and how they're going to prevent it from happening in the future. And at times we may take that into consideration in our mutual settlement process. And so mutual settlement provides a way for us to resolve violations without having to go through formal legal proceedings. And we assess penalties based on our mutual settlement protocol. We have a calculation methodology. And it allows us to interact with the violator to settle and achieve compliance for violations. And the settlement can include payment of penalties and or sometimes through this mutual discussion and interaction, we may come up with some supplemental environmental projects which can reduce emissions in lieu of paying penalties for violations. So we have 1.5 inspectors that do our asbestos NESHAP program. And NESHAP stands for National Emission Standard for Hazardous Air Pollutant. And the hazardous air pollutant in this case is asbestos. And this program is really looking at asbestos in building materials. And so we've been delegated authority by the Environmental Protection Agency, because this is their federal regulation, to regulate and enforce this NESHAP. And so it covers most renovation and demolition projects, excluding single family dwellings. And this program requires a survey. And so they have to go through the building and figure out whether there's any asbestos containing building materials. And they notify us 10 days either before that renovation or demolition. And then the regulation always also requires certain work practice standards and disposal requirements to ensure that asbestos is a hazardous material and it just goes to the right landfill. And then our inspectors go out and inspect the work sites to make sure that they're complying with the requirements of the regulation. And then finally, we receive complaints from the public, and these range from odor complaints, smoke, dust, asbestos, and gas stations. So we'll collect information from the complainant, and we will either go and do a field inspection, or we may, depending on what the complaint is about, sometimes we have to refer it to another agency. For gas stations, for example, weights and measures really are the ones. Sometimes people will call us and say, I just pumped the gas and the gallons and the dollars don't match up. And so in that case, we have to refer them to weights and measures because that's their jurisdiction. So we usually will have to determine when we receive that complaint, how we will handle it. But the most common complaints that we get are odors and smoke. And smoke would be from outdoor burning. It could be from a chimney or recreational fire. So there can be different types of smoke complaints that we receive. So with that, I will take any questions.
Amy, thank you. That was a very comprehensive overview of many of the district functions. I think it would be helpful to identify how we relate to the air quality standards, you know, just as background information, and how the advisory committee is involved in the permitting and compliance programs.
Sure. So do you mean like the 8-hour ozone standard, how that relates to engineering and compliance?
I think it's helpful for people to know that we're a maintenance area. That's what I was talking about.
Oh, I see. Okay. So there are federal and state ambient air quality standards. And so our three counties are attainment for all federal standards. So that's ozone, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, particulate matter, PM10 and PM2.5. And then the state standards were attainment for all of those same pollutants except for PM10. And so we're actually really excited that we, I think it was just this year, Dave, that we got designated attainment for the state 8-hour ozone standard. So we're doing really well here in terms of air quality for criteria pollutants. And then as how the advisory committee would intersect with engineering or compliance would probably most often be if we are doing any rule development, either a new rule or if we're changing an existing rule, we always bring those to the advisory committee before we take those to the board.
Okay, thank you. Alan, you have a question or comment?
Just a question. If you got a complaint about asbestos contamination, say like in a school, possibly from airborne contaminants. As we know, we have areas of the county where asbestos is a problem. Do you have a response to that in as part of your enforcement program, or how is that handled these days?
So are you talking about like building materials asbestos or asbestos?
No, I was talking about air. Outside entering entering inside, and if you got a complaint, say, is there a response that you would do or investigation of that type of contamination? I know this is a loaded question because it's
No, I'm just trying to, so you're saying the asbestos is in the dust or somehow coming from outside to inside? Yes. Okay, so it might come in more as a dust complaint. There's a state airborne toxics control measure for naturally occurring asbestos. Many areas of our three counties don't show up on the map as having naturally occurring asbestos, and we don't have a method to measure the air for asbestos. But definitely if there was some type of construction work or something going on that's causing that dust to get into the air, watering is the best way to control it. So we would go out in the field and respond to that complaint and try to, you know, assess what is going on.
Okay, Lacey.
Thank you, Amy, very much. I appreciate that overview. I have two quick follow-up questions. One, there is a complaint and any necessary sort of agreement that comes out of that complaint. Is that all public information? Is that searchable or findable by the general public?
We don't have it on our website, but we do often get public records requests for information about different types of complaints. So, you know, we'll just export the data from our database. We put that in our database and we could provide that. The only thing is we won't provide the name of the person who submitted the complaint.
Okay.
We keep that confidential.
Sure, thanks. Another quick question, sorry, Janet. We have a lot of federal agencies, obviously, within our area. Do you oversee the federal sort of military bases and things like that? Or is that done by the EPA or by the federal government?
So it depends on the program. So I think parts of former Fort Ord were Superfund sites. So we don't have any authority to permit things if it's a Superfund site. But for all of the buildings that are being demolished, that asbestos NESHAP that I mentioned, that applies to all those buildings. So we are keeping a close eye on what they're doing. Our staff go out there often and make sure they're following what they need to do for that asbestos program.
Karen, Greg?
Amy, I was wondering, I saw that the Bay Area Quality Resource District just put out a summary of their complaints, what different complaints they got last year. And they had listed for smoke complaints over 2,000. Do you know how many in the Monterey Bay Air Quality District or Resource District that had complaints regarding smoke last year?
Yes, hang on. Just let me look that up really quick because I do have that. So just as an general number, we only get about 250 total complaints every year. So
in total of all complaints?
Right. So we're seeing much smaller numbers in total from Bay Area. So let me just see if I can find.
Let's see. Bob Smith.
So in 2020, we received 243 complaints. And I think the largest portion of those were smoke complaints, but it was probably around 40. Sorry, I'm just trying to see if I can find my. Sorry, I'm trying to find the presentation I did back in.
That's okay. You know,
we can email it too.
Okay.
Yeah, just consider that there's 9 counties and considerably higher population in the Bay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So in 2020, we got 84 smoke complaints and 107 odor complaints.
And I was wondering, when you have that application or authority for construction, out of those total, what is the percent that, I'm just curious, the percentage that come up with violations after receiving the authority to construct?
Great
number.
It's pretty low. I'm trying to think, last year, good thing I have the same presentation open. I could tell you last year we only issued 40 notices of violation. So again, you know, last year was maybe a little different because of COVID, but we don't issue on a routine year lots of violations.
Yeah. Thank you.
My question was on complaints. I know there's some your agency doesn't do, and you I believe send them off to fire departments, the complaints of people doing residential backyard burning or burning garbage in their fireplaces. Can you talk about where the line is on which ones you'll handle and which ones you'll refer people to other agencies?
So typically for smoke complaints, we would handle those. So we do have a rule 438 that applies to residential backyard burning. So we would respond to that. Oftentimes that fire departments call us or we call them, depending on who's issuing the permit. And then for burning garbage in a fireplace, because we can't enter somebody's private property, it would be nearly impossible for us to substantiate that somebody was burning garbage in their fireplace. So we would let them know that we received a complaint, and we may go out and, you know, do a check from the sidewalk, maybe take a picture, but we wouldn't be able to definitively prove that they were burning garbage in their fireplace. And then there are certain complaints related to odors from composting that would fall under either CalRecycle or the local enforcement agency. And then agricultural operations, again, we cannot enforce nuisance complaints against agricultural operations.
Okay, if there are no other questions, we will go on to Rich's report.
Thanks, Janet. So I'll try to be really quick here. From the April and May board meetings, we didn't really have a lot on our regular agenda for April, but we did use closed session with the board. We're in negotiations with our union, so that's been taking up a lot of time. Last month, we held the first public hearings for our budget and also for our fee rules. We're proposing a 2% increase for most of our fee categories. Last year, because of COVID, we did not increase any fees and staff did not receive a raise. So this month, we will be holding our final public hearing, which is required by state law. So we have two hearings and we'll be going over the fees as well. Just to give you updates on what's going on at the district, consistent with the governor's blueprint to reopen California, we'll be opening our doors to the public on June 15th, and staff will also be returning to work as well. We've implemented a work from telecommute policy, so a number of staff will be working from home on a limited number of days per week. And then based on conversations with several board members, and I'm throwing this out to the advisory committee as well, we plan to, going forward after we open up, offer a hybrid type of meeting that will be available to board members as well as our hearing board and the advisory committee. We should have additional technology in our boardroom, which will allow us to teleconference people in. So that won't occur until August. So we are dark in July. So look forward to, if everything goes as planned and we don't have another outbreak or anything, we'll be inviting you to show up here at the office should you desire to come by, and we'll have the necessary protections available to for your personal health. Also, I just wanted to recognize, many of you probably don't know this, but today is Ann's last advisory council or committee meeting. She will be retiring at the end of July.
Wow. So
wish her all the luck and much success in her future endeavors. She's been a rock here and really gonna miss her. And then we've actually been going through the recruitment process to find a replacement. And she's leaving some pretty big shoes. I think we have to hire like 5 different people to do the work that she's going to be doing. So we're also recruiting for a new air monitoring specialist, as one of our air monitoring specialists retired after 31 years with the district. So you can only imagine how much experience we lost with that.
Who retired?
That was Scott Norton.
Who?
Scott Norton.
Oh, Scott. Okay.
Yeah, he's been here since the beginning when we were setting up our monitoring network. And he was a drone pilot. We paid to get him a license as a drone pilot. We're doing some vertical air measurements and profiling the atmosphere with drones now. So we're really going to miss him. His last day was May 4th. So we're going through the interview process for that as well. And then consistent with what Amy was talking about with respect to compliance and complaints, we have a standing item on our board agenda, which deals with marina odors. So we've been updating the board on complaints received regarding odors in the Marina Business Park area, which includes the landfill, the wastewater treatment plant, a composting operation, and other things. It's just a mess down there. And although we don't have any way to apportion or assign blame to any of those sources, we know that there's a pretty stinky problem, but most of that occurs during the months between October and April. So we're sort of in a period, and we think it's mostly meteorology, that we are not really receiving any complaints, and we have not received any since March 17th. So the board wants to know about that, and the public's very interested in that too. And there's talk of several of those sources of air pollution or odors coming together to do an apportionment study, which would assign some of the responsibility to one of the sources that may be contributing the most to the odor problem. And then this is another hearing. Our hearing board conducted our first variance hearing of the year, and that was on April 12th and continued to the 19th. And that was for Granite Rock, which was approved to allow operation of a low NOx burner while waiting for PG&E to complete modifications to natural gas feed line to their burner. In planning and air monitoring, we closed the Spare the Air program at the end of April. That's dealing with wood stoves and fireplaces. And that's because the people aren't using them as much in the springtime. And if they did, the smoke dispersion is greatly improved during the springtime anyways. But similar to what happens in the Bay Area, and we piggybacked on what they do, we issue spare the air alerts, and we ask residents to voluntarily curtail the use of wood stoves or wood fuel devices so that they don't add to the problems associated with stagnant air conditions. And that's typically, what we see when we have inversions in the valley. We've taken down the seasonal air monitors that we have in Felton, Zianti, Boulder Creek. Those are put up to monitor wood smoke from wood stoves during the wintertime months. And then our wood stove changeout program, which coincides with that as well, we received over 124 applications, and only 8 of those were low income. That doubles the amount that the folks are eligible for. But in all, we've got about 158 project funds obligated. And we've put a waiting list in place too, since we know not all of those folks will come through with their applications. And hopefully, David, you were able to take advantage of that program. That's offered to all of our residents, including board members and councilor or community advisory committee members as well. And then also we just shut down our application period for the diesel engine and equipment replacement program, which uses state grant funds for replacing higher polluting diesel equipment and engines with cleaner burning models. We've received over 120 applications. This is another one of those projects where we're trying to fine tune. We're trying to maximize the number of projects we can incentivize. instead of just giving out, some districts just give out huge sums of money. We're trying to increase the number of projects we can fund, and it looks like we're being pretty successful by offering a lower amount, but we're actually touching more projects. And then this is something I'm really proud of. Our air monitoring staff is going to be installing a sensor network for wildfire smoke this summer. And we're probably one of the first air districts in the nation to do this. We've ordered 25 Clarity air sensors, and we'll be installing them primarily at school sites. But we have already deployed about 10 of those, and we're working with the provider Clarity right now in developing a map to show the public real-time smoke values and concentrations. And we're currently working with the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, which is the state's preeminent toxicology resource. And they are going to be helping us with messaging, because right now most of our air quality index values are based on 24 hours of exposure. That doesn't do much for people that are getting bombarded by ultra high levels of smoke in shorter periods of time. So we're looking at trying to develop some health data and statistics on that. And then finally, I'll just let you know that I let the board know this. We're not really always on board with what the American Lung Association is selling, but they have an annual state of the air report. I misspelled state there, but Salinas always ranks within the top 20 cities this year. I think they were in the top 25 for year-round PM2.5 pollution. So it's really good for Salinas, and that's primarily because it's one monitor that ALA looks at, and it's out by the airport in Salinas, which has very little industrial sources or neighborhood or wood smoke or anything like that. The other features of the report is the Monterey County received an A grade for ozone pollution, and this is for the 2017-2019 air monitoring period. Santa Cruz and San Benito counties received B grades, and the American Lung Association has a methodology that's sort of, it doesn't make sense to a lot of air quality management folks, but they employ it nonetheless, and they generate a lot of interest in their state of the air report. My association, the California Air Pollution Control Officers Association, each year used to issue a competing statement about air quality. Most, by and large, air quality is improving throughout the state, but it seems the American Lung Association concentrates on the more negative aspects. For PM2.5, the American Lung Association gave a failing grade for all three counties, and I think that's because of the wildfire smoke that we've experienced. We don't really get that counted against us in a regulatory arena, because we're actually able to ask for an exceptional event exclusion for something we can't control, which is wildfire smoke. And so though that's not factored into determining our air quality status that Amy talked about, whether we're in attainment or non-attainment. So, but we do have to go to steps with the EPA and the California Air Resources Board to document those exceedances and explain that they were exceptional events caused by wildfire events. So we're thinking, just to leave on an unhappy note, is everybody saying this is gonna be the worst fire season on record? And that's sort of been evidenced by the Palisades fire that's already taken place in down in Southern California. And the fire was growing even during periods of precipitation. It's so dry down there. So we're hopefully, I mean, knock on wood, that we won't see any other wildfire events this summer, but chances are we will. And that's been really impacting our summers, actually year round. The Thomas Fire in LA was in December in 2017. So that impacted us as well. So, we're preparing for the worst, and hopefully our monitors will all be deployed by then, and we'll be able to provide a greater resolution and granularity to the public when they ask how their air quality is. So that concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? If not,
Karen, get Karen up there.
Karen Gray has.
Oh, Karen, okay. Hi, Richard. I know we talked about this a little bit before, but I still have concerns about this wood stove exchange program. I'm just wondering if we're exchanging stoves that with something that isn't much better than what they people already have. I mean, is it maybe that money could be used instead for a public information campaign or something?
Well, we do a lot of public information campaigns in addition to the wood stove. And that's as I mentioned to you, we've done videos, we've done a lot of pamphlets, we frequent the retailers and drop off information. We've been trying to get people to burn correctly because you're right. Actually, you can turn a really efficient stove into a smoke bomb really easily by burning wet wood. And that's one thing we'll never be able to control is the fuel. So unless you go to a pellet stove, and that's another story. But we can look at that. But it looks like we have fewer dollars this year anyways for that program. And we are working at the national level right now to ascertain whether or not the EPA certifications mean anything. There's been quite a controversy right now that the EPA certifications have been bypassed by industries, and that's the wood stove industry. And they are sort of cheating on the tests and therefore rendering their stoves as making their stoves certified to meet EPA standards, but in real world conditions, they fail miserably. So there are good stoves out there that are on the market too, and we do try to point people to those as well.
David Mack, you had a question?
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on the wood stove replacement. Unfortunately, I did not take advantage of the program for the second year. But I think there, as Richard said, I think there are some replacement stoves that maybe don't function as well and aren't a benefit. But it's very similar to the e-bike program. You have to spend money to get the efficient stoves. And I'll just say for me, I was looking at it, right? I was quoted between $5,500 and $9,500. You know, to get the higher efficiency, higher output stove. I'm not gonna lie, I'm still looking at a wood burning stove because I just like them better. I don't like relying on gas and I don't like pellet stoves. But again, it's like the e-bikes, right? If you want a high efficient one that's probably EPA, truly EPA consistent, you're spending near $10,000 with installation and purchase and everything else. But I do think that the program's effective, especially since it's geared towards San Lorenzo Valley and Santa Cruz, where there is an abundance of wood burning stoves. And you can tell the difference almost immediately.
And this goes to Spencer's remark, but we are oversubscribed on that program. That money disappears really quickly. So it's not laying around. People gobble it up and they're really happy to avail themselves of any kind of incentive for wood stoves. So we're going to be fine tuning it. There's been a lot of strings attached to the money in the past with the state. They didn't allow for pellet stoves. There's some really good pellet designs out there too, David. So maybe we should talk as well.
Okay, thank you. Next item is future agenda items. And I have a couple of suggestions. AMBAG is in the middle of preparing its community strategy for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And we might have a presentation on the plan that they're developing. And in addition, Monterey has a climate action plan. Carmel is in the middle of a climate action plan preparation, and Gonzales has one. And those plans are designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and be a substitute for thresholds of significance for CEQA purposes. And I think a presentation from somebody knowledgeable about CAPS would be of interest to the committee. And, you know, you may have to get somebody, oh, and the county is working on a CAP as well, right? You might want to get somebody from the state who is knowledgeable about what goes into a CAP. So, but, or you could have somebody from the county come, or Monterey, or whatever. But I think those two items would be of interest. So are there other suggestions for programs or agenda items? If not, the next item is comments from the chair, and I just made them. comments from committee members. So, Richard, our next meeting
I did have a comment. With regards to our future meetings, we skip July normally, and then August would be the, are you anticipating meetings in August, the meeting in August then? I think you mentioned about August earlier, Richard.
If we were to have a meeting in August, I probably should have said that way, we would definitely open it up for people to attend in person here. At this point, I'm not sure we have agenda items. I have to check with staff and see if we have a need for advisory council input at that point. We could go ahead and try to schedule AMBAG in Monterey County or one of the other CAP developers to speak at that time, if that's the desire of the committee at this point.
And do you anticipate our future meetings will also be Zoom meetings, or are you gearing up for we would be actually meeting in person in the future? I don't know if you have anything from.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say, is that we will be opening it up for in-person meetings in August. Okay. We would probably do it in July.
I thought that was a special, kind of a special thing, but our normal meeting would be, we'll be meeting together in the probably.
That's correct, and you will have the option to participate by Zoom as well.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay. Any other comments from the committee? Okay. If that, there are no other comments, good luck to you, Anne. Good luck for all, you know, in the future. And good luck to Alan. We'll miss both of you. So, and certainly tell Scott Norton good luck if he comes back.
Well, Alan's around for a while, so he's talking about the beginning of next year. So,
still the end of this, the end of this year.
Yeah. Okay. See, you're splitting hairs there.
All right. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Ciao.
Thank you. Bye-bye.